Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of A2Easy. I have Dan here with me.
Hello there. So, what's the topic for today?
Well, I just wanted to say I'm sorry that we haven't actually produced any content before we get to the topic for like a month or so, but I would like to congratulate Helen. This isn't her fault, by the way. I would like to congratulate Helen for actually becoming a doctor. She's our editor.
Woo!
Woo, indeed. Okay, I can't wait to get that soundbite. But the topic, since you asked, is diverticular disease.
Right. I was expecting you to say diverticulitis. What do you mean by diverticular disease exactly?
I'll be honest, I was actually getting this slightly wrong until very recently, definitely not this morning. But diverticular disease means symptomatic diverticulosis. Diverticulosis just means the presence of diverticula in the GI tract. This is a chronic state, okay? Diverticulitis is the acute state, where a diverticulum, M singular, is inflamed, often secondary to an infection. Diverticular disease is a slightly broader term than diverticulitis, as it encompasses this inflammation or other problems like diverticular bleeding.
Okay, but you still haven't said what a diverticulum actually is yet.
Well, it's my turn to bore you with some etymology, Dan. Don't worry.
No.
It comes from the Latin word for a byway, which is an old term for a side street. If you think of the GI tract as one long road, a diverticulum is like a blind-ended alley shooting off from it. The way of describing them in an exam setting, I guess, is an outpouching of the GI tract wall leading to a blind lumen. They're often very small, maybe a few millimetres in size. These patients will often have maybe 10 to 30 in their gut, but that's sort of a ballpark figure. Any idea where, anatomically speaking, they're most commonly found?
I'm pretty sure it's the descending colon.
Correct. Although, to be more specific, they are most commonly found in the sigmoid colon.
There are different types of diverticula, no?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, we can talk about true and false diverticula. The distinction is based on how many layers of the wall the outpouching contains. If it contains all the layers, it's a true diverticulum. If it doesn't, it's false. The vast majority of diverticula are false, point one. Pop quiz, how many layers does the wall of the colon have?
I'm going to go with four.
Oh, yeah, correct. From inside to outside, it's the mucosa, the submucosa, which makes sense, and then the muscularis mucosae, which is basically the muscle layer, and then the serosa on the outside. So with the first letters, if you like, it goes MS, if you were particularly keen to remember that for some reason. The important thing is that there's commonly a defect in the muscularis layer, the muscular layer, which lets the inner mucosa and submucosa poke out through.
Why does that happen exactly?
The truth is we don't know why for sure. The sigmoid colon is common because it's the smallest diameter part of the colon. There's a suggestion that the holes in the muscularis occur at weak points, such as where the blood vessels pass through. During periods of increased pressure, these weak points can break and allow for the inner layers to push through.
Okay, so that explains false diverticula. Are there any important true diverticula to know?
Yeah, there's kind of one. The one that comes up in exams anyway is a Meckel's diverticulum. I would know that this is a congenital remnant that should have been obliterated. I don't know why it's always that phrase, but obliterated during development. It's part of the vitelline duct, which you will of course remember from embryology.
Yes, of course, the vitelline duct. So Meckel's is a true diverticula. Anything else to know about it?
It's a different topic, really, but there is an associated rule of two, which I'll just go through quickly if you like. It's firstly that it affects 2% of the population. It's twice as common in boys than in girls. It's often located 2 feet, because this is obviously written in imperial times, proximal of the ileocecal valve, so the bit between the ileum and the cecum. So to be clear, this is a problem of the small intestine. It's about 2 inches in length. It's made of 2 types of tissue from the stomach and the pancreas. And then finally, it tends to present with bleeding before the ages of 2 years old. I really wouldn't learn anything more than that. That's probably more than enough, frankly. The good news is the whole terminology of true and false pathology is not unique to diverticular, so that idea is worth getting your head around for other conditions.
Right, okay. So Meckel's are true diverticular, and it helps us to remember the rule of two, which interestingly mentions nothing about a master or an apprentice.
Oh, no.
Switching back to
No, you can keep that. That's fine.
Right, okay. So Meckel's are true diverticular and it helps to remember the rule of two. Switching back to false diverticular, are there any risk factors for regular diverticular disease?
it's a very common condition, okay? And plenty of people will have silent diverticular disease with no complications. This, to reiterate from before, is diverticulosis, okay? It's common after the age of 50, but you will regularly see patients who have it who are younger now. It's more common in Western populations, and that is thought to be because of the relatively low fiber intake and the higher rates of obesity. Weirdly, it's common for Asian populations to develop diverticular disease on the right side of the colon.
That is weird. Okay, so how does it present?
Well, diverticulosis is a silent condition that would likely only be picked up on an incidental finding on something like a colonoscopy. Diverticulitis, on the other hand, is what brings patients into hospital. Patients typically complain of acute onset abdominal pain localized to the left iliac fossa.
Or possibly the right iliac fossa in Asian populations?
Yes, absolutely. As it's an infection, the body will increase its basal metabolic rate and patients will have a fever as well. But perhaps more distressing, however, is the bowel movement changes. It can cause diarrhea with fresh blood, diverticular bleeding, or it can go the opposite end of the spectrum and cause constipation and even bowel obstruction chronically. So it's a bit of a range.
Okay. So let's say when you examine these patients, are there any particular findings?
So left iliac fossa tenderness is classic, and they might be a bit distended, they might be full feeling in their abdomen. There can be a bit of a range of findings depending on the severity of the case. So this is perhaps a good time to clarify the abdo exam terminology that we all sort of use readily. This is a whole side track, but I think it's worth covering. So firstly, surprise that pain is what the patient tells you they are experiencing. It's a symptom. Tenderness is eliciting that pain when you are pressing down on the abdomen. On the other hand, a soft, non-tender abdomen is slang for a normal examination. But so tenderness is a sign that you elicit. Then there are different types of tenderness. Percussion tenderness, it's easy to check for before doing a full abdo exam, in my opinion, because it sort of gives you a heads up of how the patient will tolerate the rest of the exam. And to do that, you just percuss the abdomen like you would the lungs, for example, and that light tap causes pain when they have percussion tenderness. Then there's rebound tenderness, which is worse when you take your hand off their abdomen. If you elicit some tenderness, it's easy to check for by saying, is the pain worse when I take my hand away? And then doing so. You will look slick in your OSCE, by the way, if you actually remember to do this, because loads of people don't. So that's percussion and rebound tenderness, and they are both suggestive of something called peritonism. Peritonism is different to peritonitis, which is confusing, I know. It's localized inflammation of the peritoneum, which suggests there is something acutely wrong in the abdomen. It's not a proper diagnosis. It's just a suggestion that there is likely something underlying this presentation. It's more of a sign. Peritonitis is widespread inflammation of the peritoneum. It's more of a diagnostic term than peritonism. Peritonitis will have a cause, for example, from feces or infection in the abdominal cavity, which you might classify as something like fecal peritonitis, or maybe biliary peritonitis from a perforated gallbladder, or purulent peritonitis from a perforated appendix. So we've already said that pain is their sensation and tenderness is that sensation caused by you examining them. Then there's also the motor response to that pain, and that's the abdominal muscles tensing up. The movement can be either voluntary or involuntary. It's generally called guarding, as the abdominal muscles tense up to guard the inner abdominal organs from harm, if you like. Voluntary guarding is less significant. It can happen because the exam makes the patient uncomfortable, which, to be honest, is pretty understandable if you've ever actually had your abdomen examined. One way to identify if the guarding is voluntary or involuntary is if it goes away when you effectively distract the patient, and that's just by talking to them about something else, trying to take their mind off it, letting them relax for a second and then having push. If it's voluntary, it should then sort of go away, and that's called to be distractible. Involuntary guarding is not distractible, and you might hear the phrase rigidity, which loosely means the same thing as guarding, but often plain rigidity refers more to the involuntary aspect. So we, even though it basically means the same thing, we kind of mean it more towards the involuntary worse side. And then finally, in severe cases, like life-threatening peritonitis, the abdomen can be fully rigid, where even before you start the proper palpation, the abdomen is just like a rock, and that's obviously really bad.
Okay, so diverticulitis can present differently based on its varied severity, but commonly has left iliac fossa tenderness. In severe cases, it'd be possible to see involuntary guarding with signs of peritonism, like rebound or percussion tenderness, and then at worst, you could find a peritonitic rigid abdomen.
Yes, absolutely. I appreciate I've just done a long rant about signs and symptoms, but it is worth knowing and being really clear on your terminology when you're writing things down, I promise you.
Okay. So let's say you've identified some mild left iliac fossa tenderness. How should we go and investigate that as diverticulitis?
Well, at the bedside, doing a PR to check for blood or hard stool can be helpful. OBS will quantify any fever. Also, note if you were querying IBD in this patient at the same time, you weren't really sure what's going on. I would just say that sending off a fecal calprotectin would not be helpful to you here. That's because it's a marker of acute GI inflammation and would be high in diverticulitis as well. So therefore, we wouldn't be doing that. In bloods, we're doing nothing fancy, okay? We're looking at the FBC to check the white cell count, and the CRP should be raised. Using these are needed because of what's coming next. And that's imaging. A contrast-enhanced abdominal CT should clinch the diagnosis here. The scan needs to show evidence of those outpouchings, as well as evidence of inflammation around the colon. And that can include non-specific features such as thickening of the colonic wall or pericolic fat stranding, for all the people who like buzzwords. The wall thickens because it's one of the cardinal features of inflammation, which is tumor, aka swelling. Fat stranding is the CT appearance that occurs as the fat responds to that adjacent inflammation.
Okay, so to recap, diverticulitis is very common over the age of 50. It presents on the left side, chiefly in Western people, and typically on the right side in Asian demographics. To investigate at the bedside, we examine their abdomen, do a PR examination. For bloods, we'll get a full blood count, CRP, use an ease. And then for imaging, a contrast-enhanced CT abdomen will help confirm the diagnosis. So let's say there's a patient coming from A&E, the scan has been done, and it confirms diverticulitis. What happens now?
So to manage diverticulitis, it's important to work out whether this is a so-called complicated or uncomplicated case of diverticulitis. We can assess that based on the CT and based on the patient's clinical presentation. So we stage the severity of diverticulitis by something called the Hinchey classification. It has four stages, four being the most severe, which is reserved patients who have fecal peritonitis, which is something I sort of alluded to earlier. They have perforated their bowel due to the diverticulitis, and now they have poo in their abdominal cavity, which will cause a life-threatening infection. It's all very bad, and they might have that rigid abdomen. If you know that the Hinchey classification exists and refers to the stage of diverticulitis, you are doing really, really well. I wouldn't learn any more detail.
Hinchey classification is for diverticulitis staging. Right, okay. So how does that even affect the management, though?
Well, we manage patients with a conservative medical and surgical approach. If it's severe disease, they are more likely to be heading for surgical options. In bog standard diverticulitis, however, the first line treatment is conservative. Admit the patient under the surgeons and make them know by mouth. You can always cancel that after a more senior person has assessment. That probably will happen. Also, don't forget to give them a proper IV fluids, as you have just said they can't eat or drink. Medically, diverticulitis is likely to be due to an infection, so you should give some antibiotics. Start with IV and then step down to oral as appropriate. NICE suggests giving carboxyclav. To manage their pain, simple analgesia like paracetamol is what's recommended, because opioids and NSAIDs can increase the risk of a diverticular perforation. If we think it's a complicated case, they might have peritonitis or rectal bleeding, then surgery can be offered. There are a few different options available. If an abscess is formed, drainage can be performed. That might be guided using interventional radiology, IR, as a percutaneous approach, but it could also be done laparoscopically or open by the surgeons. If the patient has peritonitis, a peritoneal lavage, aka a washout, is indicated. To further manage a perforation, you can remove the faulty piece of bowel. As we said before, this is most commonly in the sigmoid, so it's a sigmoid resection. The exact name of the operation depends on what the surgeon then does next. If they join the remaining two ends of the bowel back together, it's a sigmoid resection with a primary anastomosis. That would be a sigmoid colectomy. If they tie off the distal end and suture the proximal end to the skin to form a stoma, it's a Hartmann's procedure, okay? Which is one of your few eponymous ones. Why would you do that? This is because it helps give the distal bowel a rest, which is important because the anastomosis of an inflamed bowel is prone to leak because of all that bowel edema and swelling we spoke about before. When a primary anastomosis is done, they can also take a more proximal loop of bowel and bring it to the skin as a stoma. That's called a defunctioning loop colostomy, and it's another option of giving the bowel the chance to rest.
So there are multiple surgical options depending on the disease severity and any complications that might have emerged up until this point. You've mentioned some already, but just to clarify, what are the potential complications of diverticulitis?
So firstly, looking at the acute complications, diverticular disease can lead to hemorrhage, as we sort of mentioned earlier, as a significant source of blood loss. This can be non-trivial. Also, don't forget that diverticulitis is often due to an infection of the diverticulum. So because it's an infection, it could also form an abscess. It could perforate, leading to fecal peritonitis, we've said already. Or it could become a source of infection, which leads to full-blown sepsis. Chronically, on the other hand, diverticular disease and subclinical diverticulitis increase the risk of, one, fistula formation, and that's to adjacent structures in the area, which can include the bladder, and that would be a colovesical fistula. Or two, stricture formation, which is due to the inflammation over time causing fibrosis and narrowing of the lumen. And that can over time eventually amount to forming bowel obstruction.
And is that it?
Almost. This isn't actually a complication, but it's important to note that when we diagnose acute diverticulitis with imaging, it's not actually always that clear cut. As I mentioned before, a key sign is bowel wall thickening, which is a bit nonspecific as a sign. It's possible that that bowel wall thickening seen is actually secondary to a cancer rather than diverticulitis. So many surgeons advocate for organising a flexi-sig in 8 weeks or so once the acute inflammation has subsided to check if it actually was in fact diverticulitis. You don't want a nasty surprise. Now that's it.
Hi everyone, it's Helen, your editor, with a summary of diverticula for you. Diverticula are blind-ended outpoachings of the bowel. Most are false diverticula, the main exception being a Meckel's diverticulum in the small bowel, a topic which can be remembered by the rule of two. Colonic diverticula are false, blind-ended outpoachings of the large bowel. They are very common over the age of 50 and in Western populations. The presence of asymptomatic diverticula is termed diverticulosis. If symptomatic in some way, that is diverticular disease. And if there is specifically an acute inflammation or infection, that is diverticulitis. It commonly presents with pain in the left iliac fossa or the right iliac fossa in Asian populations. Diverticulitis also tends to cause a change in bowel habit, ranging from constipation to diarrhea. At the bedside, a PR exam can identify any bleeding or impaction. The abdominal exam findings are varied, and in severe cases, patients can present with a peritonitic rigid abdomen. White cell count and CRP are classically raised. A CT abdo-pelvis with contrast will confirm the diagnosis, and the Hinchey classification can be used to determine severity. Patients can be managed medically with IV antibiotics, analgesia and fluids. Invasive options are varied. If there is an abscess, drainage is needed. If there's peritonitis, a washout, and if perforated, resection is often required. Diverticulitis can transform into full-blown sepsis acutely, whilst chronically can promote fistula and stricture formation. Colorectal cancer can mimic the CT findings of diverticulitis, so a flexi-sig in 8 weeks after the episode is useful to investigate the presence of diverticula or malignancy, but this is rare.